Okay, so we have the tremendous schus to learn Gittin this year. And it is a schus, even though it seems depressing. And that's a part of what we'll try to understand a little bit also. And today, especially, we want to get some kind of a perspective on what this Masechta is about. And that refers to both the halacha and lamdas of it, and also the philosophy of it, which are generally interwoven. And that's what we'll try to, especially today, get a little bit of a perspective on. And a few years ago, I guess about 8 years ago, they had a siyum here downstairs in the Beis Medrash for Daf Yomi for Seder Moed. So that would have been about 8 years ago, about 8.5 years ago. And I had the opportunity then to introduce Seder Nashim and to try to talk a little bit about the structure of Seder Nashim and the philosophy of it and the message that the halachos come together to teach us. And what I tried to present then is that Seder Nashim, so Nashim here, we don't really mean women, literally. We mean Nashim in the sense of Ishtos Obeso, basically the household, the family. And that Seder Nashim is about creating relationships and about what it means to be related, both biological families and also communities. And a lot of that runs through this whole Seder. And that's why Yevamos, for example, which focuses on a halacha, which hopefully shouldn't come up too often, very sad situation, but the bare bones of it, the fundamentals of Yevamos, are about what it means to be related, what it means. It starts off the first Mishnah counting off relationships, and it has to do with responsibility of a sibling to another. It has to do with the concept of relationships overall. It's the theme that you find throughout the Seder, ending in Kiddushin. And Kiddushin is, of course, the most intense relationship a person can have, the spousal relationship, the marriage relationship. And the Gemara there in the second part of Kiddushin, at the beginning of the second part of Kiddushin, has a fascinating comment where it tells us that the mitzvah of love between spouses is essentially the same mitzvah of love for everyone, of love for all Jews. The Torah's language of Yahavta L'Reacha Kamocha is applicable to all of us, and is applicable also between spouses. And yet, clearly, it's not the same. Clearly, there's expected to be a much more powerful and intense love between a spouse, but it's connected to the same pasuk. So the idea that relationships are being conveyed in the Seder and culminating in that Masechta, Masechta's Kiddushin, comes out powerfully from that idea that we're taught how to relate to each other, and sometimes through the prism of the most powerful relationship, and that is the marriage relationship. So Gemara brings that up in the context where it says that it's theoretically possible to have somebody pick a wife for you and marry her on your behalf through shlichus, but we don't advise it because maybe you won't be happy with the choice. And says the Gemara, what about the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha? So clearly, it doesn't mean that the standard is the same as between any two guys in the Beis Medrash, but it means that that same mitzvah applies in different levels of intensity to different people, but it's all part of that whole scale of feeling responsibility for another and identification and recognizing what a relationship could be. So that closing theme of Seder Nashim is Kiddushin. So what's very striking is that before we have Kiddushin, so we have Gittin. And it's often joked that the reason Gittin is before Kiddushin in the Mishnayos and Shas, the joke, so to speak, the somewhat cynical comment, is Hikdim Refuah L'Machla, that the cure is given before the disease. So therefore, you learn about Gittin before you learn about Kiddushin. And that sounds like a cynical statement, and it's like somewhat of a joke. But I think there is a certain truth to it, which is a part of what we'll discuss today, not in the negative sense that it sounds like that, okay, here's the remedy to the disease, so to speak. Chalila to think of marriage that way. But there is a great value to, before learning about Kedushin, appreciating the significance of Gittin and just recognizing the fragility of relationships and really internalizing just how precious they are and how much work they take, and to come into Kedushin having internalized the values of Gittin means that there is much more appreciation that comes into the Kedushin process. And so in a sense, that's what Gittin does for us, and it's true in a broad sense, but we'll see it also in a more specific, targeted sense today as we go more with more focus into some of the sources, that there really is essentially a theme of what Gittin is telling us. And Gittin does help us connect to a sense of just how fragile relationships can be. And that doesn't itself even have to be a negative. So here we're already saying it's here to support the positive of Kedushin. But even within that, it sounds negative saying, okay, so respect marriage, but just know that it could end at any time. That also sounds kind of scary. But it doesn't necessarily have to be looked at from that way. Just having a recognition of how precious something is itself valuable, even without having a looming shadow over it all the time. And this is actually something that comes up in next week's Parsha, in Parsha Shoftim, because there we read about a commandment to add Ari Miklat, to add the cities of refuge in Eretz Yisrael, to give more places someone can go to if he has to run away from a vengeful relative because he caused somebody's death. And there, so the question comes up, it sounds like this mitzvah is actually for the future, is for Yemos Mashiach. So the question is, what's the need for that in a time when you're not going to have these situations happening? So why do we need to have more Ari Miklat? We should have less. We should have none. So some of the Balei Machshava point out, if I remember correctly, Rashi Karbi Avne made this observation, and others, Ritzel and Rashi Kovit, that the more that it's not going to be relevant to have the actual fear of death, so the more we need to be reminded of just how precious it is. It's Olam Hazeh, we need to be reminded of something's preciousness and value through the fear of loss, but the highest madrega is to be able to appreciate it in of itself. And sometimes that requires even more effort to be able to connect to. So ideally, in the best case scenario, so we shouldn't have to know from Gittin, but the recognition of the concepts of Gittin should help to strengthen the concept of marriage, and really in the fully positive sense, that there should be a appreciation for just what that means and what that can offer. And this is true hashgafically on a number of levels. And as some point out, that there is also a lot of references to the Churban throughout this Masechta, including the main section of the Gemara that one is permitted to learn on Tisha B'Av appears in Maseches Gittin, and that's the most prominent, but there are other references also. So the theme of the Churban and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship to the Jewish people and how precious that is and how vulnerable that is and how much that requires constant attention is also interwoven with the personal dynamics within the Maseches Gittin, and that's also something to appreciate. So there is a lot to be said for that, that this Masechta does help us to value relationships, relationships with each other, relationships with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and that's one of the dominant themes throughout this Masechta. And you got to see today, I saw throughout the morning that many of you were on the last lines of the Masechta, so you already made it through everything. But, you know, the very last line of Gittin, as you see, the Gemara has this statement of Kol Magarish Ishtar Rishona, Filo Mizbeach, Mardel of Demos, that somebody who divorces his first wife, the Mizbeach, cries. And the relationship here, again, being drawn between the Beis HaMikdash and the personal relationships, that's itself being highlighted here. But the message that maybe there's more that could have been done. Sometimes it's not the case, as we'll discuss a little bit today. There's all kinds of reasons why marriages end. It's a part of what we'll also talk about how they can be very different from each other, the reasons, and some are more understandable and necessary than others. But sometimes it has to do with a mizbeach kind of focus. So there are those who suggest that it means to symbolize the fact that relationships require sacrifice, require a give and take. And sometimes if there's something missing on that level, so maybe that's what causes the relationship to fall apart. Obviously not always, but sometimes that has to be a warning signal. And that's a little bit what this imagery comes to highlight as well. So that is all more on the broad kind of hashkafic level. But what we will see over the next few minutes is that it really does seem to be playing out within the actual details of Gittin and the concept of Gerushin and Get in and of itself. So first of all, so one mucker, no, you all did see this morning, however far you got. So you saw the Pasuk in Parshas Kiseitze. Do we have a Chumash in the room? We usually don't. Helpful if they have the Chumash. So, if not, I will call one up. But the point of the Pasuk, so sometimes we're able to work it out that we can start the year when the Parshas HaShavua is in sync with the Masechta. So very often it starts Kiseitze is half of Mitzvahs in the Torah, and especially half of Seder Nashim, so or all of Seder Nashim really. So if we were in Parshas Kiseitze now, we'd have even greater ability to do that. Parshas Shoftim also has a lot. We were learning Chulin, would have worked well, but okay, so we didn't get it exactly in sync this year, so we'll have to talk to the powers that be about that. But it'll be the Parsha in 2 weeks, and Parshas Kiseitze. So the Torah does have most of the principles of Seder Nashim in it. And you saw the Pasuk at the very beginning of Perech Avdala. The language is Ki Yikach Ish Isha Uva'ala. So that's one of the phrases, one of the times that phrase appears. That implies a mitzvah of Kiddushin, a process of Kiddushin. So when there is a halachic marriage, what happens? V'hoya imlo simsochein be'ena. So maybe he's not going to be so fond of her anymore. Ki matzava ervas davar, v'chasav la sefer krisus v'nasam v'yada v'sholchem ibeisu. So then there's going to be a separation. There's going to be a divorce, and that divorce happens through these key words: v'chasav la sefer krisus. He's going to write for her this book, this bill of divorcement. In Talmudic language, we call it a get, and we'll come back to that question of where that language comes from. But that's the Talmudic language, not the language of the Torah. The Torah calls it a sefer krisus. As we also will see, get really does not exclusively mean a bill of divorce. It comes to mean all kinds of contracts, but gitei nashim is the more complete phrase. So v'chasav la sefer krisus v'nasam bi'ada v'shulcha mi'beiso. So this pasuk contains almost all of it. The next pasuk fills in a little bit more. V'yatza mi'beiso v'halcha v'haisa li'isha acher. So that phrase also becomes very crucial. But together with those two psukim, you have almost all of Maseches Gittin in it. You have almost all of the details, and essentially this next 90 blot is about expounding the meaning of those words. So, just off the top of your heads, and the answer to this is going to be much more than I'd expect you to give me in the next few minutes, but what comes first? So when you see a pasuk like that, so what are some of the open questions we're going to want to find answers to? And some of them will come to much earlier than others, but what leaves room for definition in that pasuk? What needs to be identified, explained? Jonathan? Okay, Ervas Davar is certainly something that's going to be a big detail, but even perhaps more fundamental, who was up first? Caleb?
What is a Sefer Kritut? What does that entail?
What is a Sefer Kritut, right? So that's going to be a major question. What is the definition of a get? And you could go further with that also. Why is it a sefer? What does a sefer mean for these purposes? Eric, you up first?
I mean, the Gemara talks about all the different definitions of key and how that changes how different Rabbanim explain it.
Okay, that's also true. There's a lot of mystery here. So how do you understand key? You know, is that meant to suggest something definite or contingent or the like? What else? What other words here require definition or exploration? We have a whole Masechta that's going to expound essentially these two psukim. Yeah, you did.
Well, like you said, but this, the relationship between lo tintachin benav, and then also about erev sefer. So, like, the relationship between those two.
Right. That's going to be
contingent on that.
So that's certainly going to be a major theme: figuring out what happened. Something went wrong, and what is it that went wrong? Is it one thing, or is it a range of things? What else? Anything else in that pasuk cries out for?
What
explanation?
What constitutes erva?
What constitutes? So that's essentially related, right? Yeah. The latter your own.
Yes. What does uvala mean, and also how does benasim biyada work exactly?
Okay, so uvala is actually part of the first part, more related to the marriage part of the pasuk. So that's certainly important too. But certainly, for our agenda here in Gittin, that's going to be a major theme. What does benasim biyada mean? And we'll see that there's going to be a lot to figure out about that and the way, and there's a fundamental challenge, which we'll have to explain later on, to the whole concept of the woman acquiring a get and how exactly that works. So a lot of the Masechta is going to have to deal with that also. What does it mean, Vinasan? What does it mean, Viada? What does it mean, Vishulcha? So that's all going to require definition. Sefer Krisus for sure is going to require definition. What does kasav mean? And what is the Torah conveying with kasav? We'll see that the halachos of lishma and the idea that there has to be particular designation of the get is going to be a major detail. So what's called ksiva? What's called giving? What's called to her? What is called the sefer? All of these details are very unclear. And they're going to require a lot of explanation, and that's a lot of what the Gemara does. And we're going to try to pick out those themes and see how they contribute to our overall understanding. And then the next pasuk is going to make a difference also, because the Gemara is going to tell us that there's a hekesh of Havaya Liyitziya, that Havaya, meaning the marriage itself, is somehow connected to the leaving the marriage, the Yitziya. So what's the relationship between the two? On the one hand, it is a contributory relationship that the first Mishnah in Kiddushin tells us that just like there is a concept of ending a marriage through the writing of a shtar, writing of a get, so too you could start a marriage that way for that reason, and it's possible to begin a marriage, to create a marriage through a shtar. It's not what we do nowadays. It's not what a ksuba is. A ksuba is something different. So we don't actually see this in practice. But theoretically, it's possible to create a marriage the same way as it is possible to end it. But that leaves open the question, which the Gemara has a drasha for also, of why it doesn't go perfectly in the other direction. Why is it that there are three methods of effecting kiddushin, but essentially only one method of ending a marriage that is in the spirit of divorce? So that, the Gemara tells us, is derived from the pasuk also. But it's interesting, something we'll have to try to understand a little bit more, the role of ksiva, of a sefer, specifically and exclusively as the method of divorce. So why is that, and what does that mean practically? That's going to also be something that's going to be on the agenda. But behind all of these questions is a broader question about how to read the pasuk. And that's what we need to start with today. Is the pasuk describing to us a mitzvah? Is it telling us something that has to happen? Is it telling us something that should happen? Is it telling us something that could happen? Is it just describing a protocol, but without making any kind of judgment one way or another? So that's a very fundamental question, and that's what we need to start with. So what's your impression so far? Is that pasuk a mitzvah? Is it not a mitzvah at all? Is it some kind of unusual mitzvah? Caleb, yeah?
I think it's a mitzvah that takes effect only in a certain situation.
Okay, so what does that mean, practically speaking? Now, we say you think it's a mitzvah, so you probably saw that certainly some of the Moneh HaMitzvos count it, right? A number of the prominent Moneh HaMitzvos count it. You saw at least the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch counted among their list of 613. Many of the other Moneh HaMitzvos counted as well. And part of the question, together with how we read the pasuk, is what's the significance of it being counted? So you want to address that?
I mean, I think it's a mitzvah more like Yibum is a mitzvah as opposed to Lulav would be, in that.
Okay, how are you defining those as different?
Like, in general, there's, we want to do mitzvah, but there's some mitzvah that are, they're just, like, not just, but they're processes in a given situation that you don't necessarily want to be in the situation, or it's an ideal situation, but given that you're in the situation, this is how you should conduct yourself.
See, it's a very interesting comparison that you're making, because there is certainly a difference between lulav and yibum, but whether yibum is perfectly correlated to get is a big question. It's in the same section of Shulchan Aruch, the same section of Shas, but there might be some big differences, so let's flesh it out a little bit more. But now, just to rephrase the question, so we have a pasuk, which might be telling us that there is a mitzvah of some kind, and we know that many of the prominent Moneh HaMitzvos did list it. So how do we relate to that? And a part of the question is, we also have to figure out why we care. And so in general, there's a book you can find in the library, the title is something like The Concept of Tayag and Who Cares? Or Why Do We Care? Why Should We Care? Something like that. Because on the one hand, the question of counting mitzvos in general is a mysterious endeavor. We have a tradition, there are 613 mitzvos, the Gemara in Makos, and Gemara is also referenced in Yevamos. So there was an endeavor that basically happened only during the time of the Rishonim, not so much before or after, but during the time of the Rishonim, so a number of them took up this task of counting. How do you figure out the 613? And before the Rishonim, we don't really have that so much. And after the Rishonim, you have Svarim that are written commenting on these Svarim. So on the Rambam, Sefer HaMitzvos, a popular Sefer to comment on. And Sefer Achinuch is a popular Sefer to comment on. And Sajagon is a very big work done on that. And a few others, such Svarim. So in the era of the Achronim, you have commentaries on what the Rishonim did to try to count up the mitzvos. But one question is, does it matter? Is that just an intellectual exercise? You could say here in this case, it's Parshas Kisetze. Parshas Kisetze has the record for the most mitzvos in the Torah, so maybe it's got its record on the line. But here, the truth is, there is going to be greater significance than that. It's going to matter more than just whether we count one way or another. Some of the Rishonim, the Ramban in one place, at least questions if we even conclude there are 613 mitzvos. There's a Gemara in Sota, which has a debate about three mitzvos, whether they are actual obligations or not. And Tosfos raises the question, well, if they're not, then we're going to have to find three more for the list of 613. So the Ramban, commenting on that question, the Ramban says, maybe there aren't 613 mitzvos. Maybe it's machlokas. Maybe that's one line in the Gemara, and maybe not everyone agrees. So counting is interesting, but it's also an interesting question why it matters. But here, there are reasons why it matters more, and that's something we need to try to flesh out a little bit. Natanael, you want to
say? So this mitzvah seems to be more like the Heshev HaSagzela, mm-hmm. in that you have come across a situation where something needs to get done, and this is the protocol of how to go about doing it.
Okay, so let's just ask that for a second. So if we're going to take it as a given that there's some kind of mitzvah here, and acknowledge that the Rambam and the Chinuch and others have all taken that position. So how does it fit in categories? So what's been pointed out by Nathanael and Sam is that, and Caleb was getting at this, maybe we're saying something different, that it's clearly different than lulav. So lulav, okay, that's a mitzvah that we have to do. It's a mitzvah say shas mangromas, only men have to do it, but it's a mitzvah that all the adult Jewish men have to do at a certain time, and we get that. Now, clearly, a mitzvah like Yibum or V'heshuvus Legzela, those are different mitzvahs, and they're different in the sense that no one's looking to perform these mitzvahs. They only come up in a certain situation. In the case of Yibum, it's a tragic situation. In the case of V'heshuvus Legzela, it requires an Aveira first. So these are not situations that anyone is looking to orchestrate. It's an interesting, keep this thought in mind as we get closer to Rosh Hashanah. It's an interesting question how the mitzvah of tshuva compares or doesn't compare to the mitzvah of Heshuvah Legzela. You know, should we say the tshuva also, which is our clear mandate over the next 43 days. So is that comparable to a mitzvah like the Heshuvah Legzela? Ideally, none of us would sin, so we wouldn't have any mitzvah of tshuva, and it's only circumstantial, or is there more to it than that? As you probably suspect. So some mitzvos are only reactions to situations. But even given that, it still leaves us with a question of whether Gittin even matches that. Why? What's the difference? What's the difference, or a possible difference, between Gittin and Yibum, or Heshuvus Legzela? What might be a better comparison, Jonathan?
One, Gittin seems like it's based on a feeling that you feel there's something wrong, as opposed to Yibum, where it's like an actual scenario that happens.
Okay, that's helpful. The fact that there is a much less objective reality to respond to, it's interesting. It's something to think about what the significance of that is. And clearly, it's going to be a lot more variable as far as how to interpret things on a couple levels, because as we've seen, we'll talk about in a minute, so the Gemara at the end of the Masechta Mishnah, the end of the Masechta, has already a couple of categories. You have to decide which one, but each one of those categories is you're also picking up on as far from absolute or objective, or at least some of them are. So that's certainly a difference, but maybe there's more to it also. Eric?
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to that, in the sense that you have a decision whether or not you want to give a get. And once you decide you want to go through divorce, these are the ways that you do it, as opposed to finding yourself in a situation. You would control the situation. I think it's kind of like, the only thing I can think of is, I think matzah. I think like on the first day, it's meant to be matzah. There's like a minimum share, but there's no maximum share. You can keep eating the matzah, and you can still be, I think, gaining mitzvahs. And there's no real obligation to keep eating and eating and eating the matzah. I think it might be through based on maybe just the first day. But at the same time, you still gain mitzvahs by doing it.
Okay, so it's interesting because that does give us another category, and that's worth identifying as another category. But it's still a good question whether that matches, because I could still find maybe a closer example.
Yeah.
But your point about matzah, not on the first night, because matzah on the first night is like lulav. Is, you know, clear directive, and there women are obligated also. So clear directive every adult Jewish person has at a certain time. But what you're referring to is the idea that's associated with the Vilna Gaon and the Meiri, that for the rest of Pesach, after the Seder, that there's what we call a mitzvah of some level to eat matzah. And that's interesting because it does create a whole other category where they call it a mitzvah kiyumis, that it's not something that you necessarily are obligated to do in the more absolute sense of lulav or matzah on the first night, but there's some value. And maybe that might compare, in a sense, to tzitzis of Bezman HaZeh. Let's say we don't have garments that are naturally obligated in tzitzis, and we choose to put on a four-quarter garment to fulfill the mitzvah tzitzis. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't necessarily be in violation of anything, at least on an absolute level. But it's an opportunity to fulfill a mitzvah. Although, I'm still not sure if it's a perfect comparison. Richie, you had something you want to say?
So if I'm correct, the Tosfos who brought Mizbachim seem to imply that it's not a mitzvah chiyuvos, right? That even if you're, you know, the wife's actually, like, if she's a zona, like, you don't have to divorce her.
All right, that Tosfos is important. But let's come back to that, because first I want to frame the question that Tosfos is going to be an answer for. So you're a step ahead of us. Hold on to Tosfos for a second. We'll come back to that, because that's a part of how to kind of highlight the question here. Okay?
Would this mitzvah be more comparable to Isha Tifat Toar?
So that's another category that's that's also hard to categorize. How do you want to draw the comparison?
Well, as in, it's not really a mitzvah that we want to perform, but it's there.
Well, so but there also one could say that really nobody has to do Eishes Yifas Torah, and it's an unusual kind of mitzvah that the Chazal at least understand it as essentially a concession, as something that's possible, as maybe preferable to the alternative. Dibur Torah Kineged Yetzirah, and that it was some kind of a concession to the realities of human weakness. But here, probably a good possible comparison that no one's gotten yet is, want to try, did you?
Sota,
interesting. Why'd you go there?
Because it's not something that you want to do, but if that's happened, like if, you know,
the circumstances
happens, then, you know, their system had to do that.
Okay. Maybe, yeah, that might be more human-like. So it might be
right.
A good comparison, but at the moment I'm looking for something else, but hold on to that, that may also fit in. Eric?
Maybe halakhas that deal with any type of sale, in the sense that this is a halakha where once you're undertaking...
If you're choosing to sell...
Yeah, once you're choosing to do the thing, this is the halakhic framework that we use to properly necessitate what you want to do.
You enter into this world, these are the rules that regulate it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would also look to possibly Shechita. So Shechita is interesting, and 3 years ago already now we learned Chulin. This was a topic at the beginning of Chulin, because nobody's old enough here for that. But there it's interesting because the comparison could swing in both directions. That it's possible to say that Shechita is a good model, and that nobody has to shecht any food, nobody has to shecht any animals. And perhaps it's possible to be a vegetarian. That's not our topic for today, but let's say theoretically that's an option. But if one is interested in eating meat, so then they're going to need to shecht in order to get it, or have somebody else have shechted it first. So for most of us, it's a funny idea, because most of us don't actually shecht our own meat, but theoretically, somebody had to shecht the meat in order for it to be edible for us. So there, that could be a good comparison, even though it's interesting, because there it's a machlokis a little bit whether to count it as a mitzvah or not, although the Rambam does count it. And, yeah?
Melech, instituting a king.
Oh, that's a very complicated one. So that's also interesting. That's a good partial topic for next week. So how Melech fits in actually is a topic of some debate also. But let's talk about Shechita for a second. So Shechita seems to be maybe a good model, right? That, oh, if you're interested in eating meat, so then you're going to have to shecht. And if you're not interested in eating meat, then you can go your whole life without shechting or having anyone else shecht. But so it doesn't mean, when you say it's a mitzvah of Shechita, it doesn't mean like lulav that you have to do it. It means that this is the way to do it halachically. This is the way to get kosher meat. So there's somewhat of a debate whether that should count as a mitzvah, more of a debate than you find by Gittin, which is interesting. But also, there's a way in which it gets a clearer mitzvah status, and that's something we're going to have to figure out, that when it comes to Shechita, there's a bracha. The bracha is recited on Shechita, and there's no bracha is recited on Get. So, why is that? So that's something we'll have to come back to. Yes, sir?
No, I just said maybe it's related to, like, Mishloach Manos, because you don't know if they're going to accept it.
So how much does that play in?
Yeah.
So, Mishloach Manos, if that's the reason, there's so many steps you need to explain to get to that, actually. So, you're on to something in a different way, but we're going to put that aside for a second, because we'll come back to that. Yes?
If you go with the other reason for Ben Adam L'Chaveiro Mitzvos, it's about, like, making a person not be your lulav. So, like, it's more than Shechita. And Shechita, both are like mutter, but one, for reasons, is clearly unideal. So to make like a bracha, and like, I'm like doing Ratzon Hashem right now. It's not exactly. You are, but you shouldn't be there in the first place.
Interesting. So here's my question. So should we say that basically it's like Shechita, however we figure out where it holds up and where it falls apart, but it's something like Shechita, that there's no positive command to do this. And when we call it a mitzvah, we don't mean a mitzvah like lulav or matzah. We mean that this is a Torah concept, a Torah-regulated idea, and that if you choose to do this, if you choose to follow this path, then this is the way to do it. So is that what's going on, that that's all it is? There's no judgment here one way or another, and you could choose to partake or not partake. But if you do, it has to be done this way. That's what we mean by calling it a mitzvah. Or could we say, no, it's more than that, that there are circumstances where it's a mitzvah, and where, yes, it is the right thing to do. Now, it's still going to be different than lulav for sure, because clearly no one's suggesting that everyone should try to perform this mitzvah at some point in their lives, and clearly, l'chachila, you wouldn't have to ever do it. But that maybe then it's closer to what was brought up before, to Yibum, or maybe, like you did just say, maybe it's even closer to Sota, maybe, and maybe that's an even better match, because like Jonathan was saying, there's some subjectivity in what brings about Sota, but that if you find yourselves in a certain situation, not ideal situation, but still, once Hashtad Das is Lachi, once you get to that point, then there is a clear path here, and that's key to the mitzvah, and that yes, this should happen under these circumstances.
The brachos on that point?
Yeah.
Brachos in generally for kavana purposes, and maybe the kavana isn't writing the get is...
So that's a good question, too. And we'll come back to the question why there's no bracha, because that could be one approach. There could be other reasons also. By the way, I'm making a game time executive decision, so reversing what I said before. I think we'll daven up here today, just so we shouldn't have to stop mid-sentence. So give us a few more minutes, so we'll, otherwise we'd have to end now. It's not a great ending point. So I'll give it a few more minutes, then we'll... It's not L yet, so we'll daven up here in a few minutes. Okay, so let's just try to focus on the question this way. So is it like Shechita? We have no moral judgment here one way or another. But should you choose to get divorced, this is the way it has to happen? Or should we say that no, there are times when it is actually the right thing to do, and we really mean mitzvah in that sense. Still, it'll be different than other things because it's not something we expect everyone to do in a lifetime, or we hope the opposite. And again, to go back to Jonathan's point, this still going to be probably subjectivity to when that time is, but maybe there are circumstances where the Torah is saying it's the right thing to do. And then it's not really so much a matter of pure discretion, but maybe it is on some level really a mitzvah. Zombie?
How's Rebbe defining a good time to do it?
Well, so then that becomes a question which, in a sense, the Mishnah in the end of the Masechta is taking on. Right, the Mishnah, in the end, which brings up the question of, which is what many of you pointed to before, so what is the role of Ervas Davar in the Pasuk as one of the things we need to identify? So what role does that play? Is that just describing a circumstance? In which case we could be saying, yeah, it doesn't have any real significance for us, just that the Torah is describing how it could come up. That divorce might happen because of something like this, and then it'll be up to you. Yeah?
There's always going to be subjectivity, though.
Meaning, yes, subjectivity.
So how are you able to get around that aspect of it's going to be subjective no matter what?
So it's mostly subjective, although the first category in the Mishnah starts looking at it. So Erva, depending on how you interpret it, could be closer to objective, but the other ones are probably more subjective. But still, to really cut things in a fine way, so there's still a difference between total discretion and have ice cream if you want or don't have ice cream if you don't want, and a situation where we're basically saying there's really a right thing to do here, but it's going to take understanding and analysis and some subjectivity as to whether it is the right thing to do. So here, just to focus on this for a few minutes, so do you get a sense from reading the Rambam, the Sefer Echinuch, and others, or especially those two, as to which it is, into which category? Did you?
It seems like it's not like Shechita, because Shkita is just like, okay, so be a vegetarian your whole life. It doesn't affect anyone, like, shkayach. But like, for like, Michal Zechinov talked a lot about it, like, literally it's like, it's a detriment, like, it's a broken kli, and, you know, it's, you're fracturing Ezer Kenegdo, and you know, and everyone's, you know, created Bitsalmo, and then you're breaking that, you know, familiar relationship. So it seems like you're doing something harmful if you don't do something proactive about that.
Okay, so that's very interesting, because I think you're right about that. And make that work, we have to point something out here. So I think you're correct that there is something in the Sefer HaChinuch, the way he presents it, that really fits into that second category. That basically, no, this isn't just purely discretionary. That the Torah includes this for a affirmative reason, I'll call it positive, but there's a reason, there are circumstances where this is really the right thing to do. And that therefore, within the presentation of the Tetameh HaMitzvos of the Sefer HaChinuch, it sounds like it's really putting it more in, let's say, the Sota category, the Yibum category, that when circumstances fall out a certain way, it's the right thing to do. And that's what we mean by mitzvah, that it is recommended under certain circumstances. Eric?
But aren't those kind of like obviously there are like a lot of ramifications in which, like, if you know, when certain things happen, you have to, obviously have to get the worst. But isn't that more like a should or shouldn't, as opposed to like having halakhic specific ramifications? Like, yeah, you're not treating your wife right, maybe you should get the worst, but it doesn't mean you necessarily have to.
You mean saying should as advice or should as a mitzvah, but a mitzvah that is still, in other words, not necessarily neutral. So, like, we could say that Shechita is neutral, essentially. If you really have no interest in getting aside questions of Yantif and other kinds of issues, let's say in general, on a regular weekday, if you have no interest in eating meat today, so fine, we have no judgment at all. So then just skip it and don't do any Shechita, don't eat any meat, and there's nothing to say. So is that the model here? Maybe, but it doesn't sound like it from the Sefer HaChinuch. It sounds like the Sefer HaChinuch, and I'll explain this a little bit more, saying the Torah put this here because there are circumstances when that's the right thing. And you could say that there's somewhat of a machlokes here between the Rambam and the Sefer HaChinuch. It's very subtle.
I was going to say, it sounded more like from the Rambam and Sefer HaMitzvos that he says, like, kishinirtzak. When the guy wants, he can do it.
So okay, right. So that's how it sounds like from the Rambam, right? The Rambam is pretty brief language in Sefer HaMitzvos. Sounds more like Shechita. Right, I'll call upon him kishigir to lagarish. And so it sounds like what the Rambam is saying is that the mitzvah here is not to get divorced. The mitzvah is that someone who is getting divorced should do it this way. That there is a proper way to carry out the divorce. So it gets triggered once one's already made that decision. But the mitzvah of gerushin that the Rambam quotes, Reish Chof Beis, number 222 in the list of positive mitzvos, what is that mitzvah? What's the thrust of that mitzvah? It's not the mitzvah to get divorced. It's a mitzvah that if someone is getting divorced, it should be done this way, with the get, and with all the rules. While the chinuch, I think what you did just saying resonates, that the mitzvah is to get divorced. Obviously not for everybody, and without just cause, but there are times when that's the right call. Now, what confuses things a little bit, just to, in the interest of full disclosure, is that I think it's a little bit, I pointed this out to somebody in the base manager, that I think it's a little bit of a discrepancy within the Sefer HaChinuch, because Sefer HaChinuch and the Rambam, as you'll see, are very often paired together. They very often have similar approaches and language and positions. Actually, this will come up tomorrow in Parshas Yiro also, so it's a little bit of synergy. You'll see, again, the Rambam and the Chinuch being in the same camp. So it happens to be the Chinuch starts off with the same language as the Rambam. So, Yaron, I think you're correct to say the Rambam sounds like that, that, oh, it's if you choose to get divorced, this is how you do it. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between the Chinuch's formulation at the beginning and his reasoning. Because I think he did just correct about the reasoning, but it happens to be the language is there in the Chinuch also. So just for full disclosure, he also starts off saying that when you want to get divorced, this is how to do it. But here, so let's just try to say this quickly. So if you look at the Tameh HaMitzvos that they each give, that perhaps could help us appreciate why there's a difference between the Rambam and the Chinuch here. That what Chedidya was alluding to is that the Sefer HaChinuch basically says that marriage is supposed to be a certain way, and there's supposed to be a benefit to the couple, that they're going to be able to grow together and to act positively and have meaningful lives because of their relationship. And we need to have divorce as a possibility, because otherwise one may not feel any sense of responsibility. It's essentially the gist of what he's saying. And he draws the comparison to other religions. So in our context, let's say this is something that's true about the Catholic Church. So in the Catholic Church, there is no divorce. There's no such thing. So marriage is for life. And that's something we'll have to consider to a certain extent, the balance between marriage being a very significant commitment and there being the possibility of divorce. So you know, very often, this is something throughout the year we'll come back to, that a lot of attention is paid to the halachic system and some of the difficulties of divorce, and get refusal and the like, and it's a complex subject, which we'll come back to later, but there's a lot of attention in the world in general that comes on that fact, that sometimes divorce is complicated in Judaism, but it's not as complicated as it is in Catholicism, where it doesn't exist, right? So not every culture or religion necessarily had a concept of divorce. So divorce in Judaism has its complexities, but it exists as a concept, which isn't a given everywhere. So the Chinuch reflects that, and he says that some religions have no such concept as divorce. And the way he seems to understand it is that could lead to people not worrying about how they function within their marriage. They could just do whatever they want because they know that they have a lifetime contract and nothing's going to change that. So there needs to be this possibility of divorce in order to make sure that the person will behave properly.
On the opposite extreme of if the tiniest little insignificance happens and you get divorced, then...
Okay, it's a crucial point. So if you look in the commentary of the Abravanel on this Parsha, on the Pasuk in 2 weeks, in Parsha Kiseitse, on this pasuk, so the Abravanel has a position that's similar to the Chinuch but different. And what he writes is that essentially he has this little similar focus but a little bit different, that marriage is supposed to be something amazing, something that has tremendous value to the couple. And if the couple is not compatible in a way, or they're not, maybe it's because someone's doing something wrong, maybe it's not, maybe it's simply just not a good fit. But if this is not able to be the relationship that it has to be in order for the marriage to be what it could be, so then to support marriage, there has to be a way to end this one and move on to another one for each party. So essentially, it's how the Abravanel presents it, that in support of the value of marriage, we have to be able to clear away a marriage that's not going to be able to work and allow it to be replaced for both parties with a different one. So that's essentially how he understands the concept existing. But he also says there, and this is a theme we're going to see throughout, so now to bring up another question, and this is going to be a major issue, is the question of why this way? Right, so why to have the get and the whole process that's involved with the get? So an idea that you find in other places also, but the idea that the Ravenel mentions here is that we want it to exist because you need to have that ability to allow the parties to enter into a better marriage, but we don't want it to be too easy. And this is something which in Maseches Ksubis, you see also there are a lot of enactments of Chazal which speak to that also, that we don't want someone in a rash temper to all of a sudden pull the plug on a marriage and that's it. So we want it to exist, but to be something that takes a effort and time in order to execute. Ironically, this is the kind of phrase you see was used to be invoked in the abortion discussion, which has changed tone over the past few months. But those were, use the phrase that Bill Clinton used to be, safe, legal, and rare. So I guess this could have worked for here. That's what the Ravenel is discussing for divorce. It should be legal and rare. You know, it should be there as something that could exist, but we don't want it to be too easy. So the process of this Masechta, the process of that Pasuk in Chumash telling us how it has to happen, is meant to be possible but not simple. That's the idea. So, hi.
One more thing. Shechita, the difference between Shechita and what we're saying get is, it seems to be Shechita doesn't really matter who it is.
Yeah.
Anyone can come and say, oh, I'm hungry, let's do Shechita. Not everyone can come and say, oh, I'm unhappy with my marriage, let's get a get.
Well, it's interesting. What do you mean by that? I mean, we may have to explore that later, because it's got a lot of aspects to it. But just on one foot, what do you mean by, because not everyone's married to that person who they want to...
Or not, like... He could say, okay, I'm not very happy right now, but I could be happy later.
The situation is more subjective. Yeah. So that's something we'll have to explore a little bit. But again, I apologize for the confused timing here. So let's just, I just didn't want to stop and move a sentence. Let's just say a little bit more and then we'll dive in. But so look at it this way. So it seems that Sefer Achinuch is essentially saying, what's the mitzvah of divorce? The mitzvah is to get divorced. And the way it has to happen is through the get. But under the circumstances, when it's necessary, that's the mitzvah. The Abravanel is basically addressing both of them, right? He's saying the mitzvah is the divorce, because that has to be there sometimes in order to allow for happy marriages. And the mitzvah is to do it this way, because that's also a part of it, that it shouldn't be a unnecessary end to a workable marriage. So both parts of the mitzvah, according to the way he presents the reasoning. Now let's go back to the Rambam for a second. So the Rambam, the way he presented it, like Yaron said, is when there's going to be a marriage ending, it has to be done this way. So presumably, according to him, the mitzvah is not the divorce, but the get, how the divorce happens, specifically. Now, why? What's the significance there? So that you could see if you look in the Mar Nevuchim. So the Mar Nevuchim, it's in Chelek Gimel, Parak Mem Tes. You can look it up if you get a chance. So the Rambam goes through all of the halachos of nashim and marriage and the like, and when he talks about marriage and divorce, they're linked together, and he explains them as being connected. And the Rambam, and this is something which also gives us a lot of room to explore, the Rambam is often quoted in his comments about marriage, the very beginning of Hilchos Ishus, where he says that before Matan Torah, so that people could just meet and decide to go home together, and there was no concept of formal marriage. And the Torah came and innovated that there has to be a formal commitment. So there's a very interesting question to discuss, we won't get to today clearly, the question of what was divorce before Matan Torah, or what does divorce mean for Bnei Noach? So that's a important question, not for today, but in the context of understanding the mitzvah of marriage, so we can understand it on a basic level, that it's about respect and seriousness, and that the Torah doesn't want just that two people who are interested in a physical relationship should be able just to go home together and then forget about it if they want to, but that the physical relationship should happen in the context of commitment, and there should be a declaration of seriousness, and that that's the way it should take place. So that's consistent with how he describes it in Mishneh Torah. In Mar Nevuchim, he goes on to say more about this, and he says that's also why there's a problem with prostitution, and why you want there specifically to be a commitment between the couple, and he talks about children also, and about how stability is important, and you want there to be an investment of the father and the children, and all of that is a part of it. So then he goes on to say that divorce, the Torah wants it to be public because it's not in the interest of stability for divorce to be something that people can just claim is true and there's no evidence of it one way or another. So, for example, he says there, if let's say the woman wanted to be unfaithful and if she was challenged on it, she could just say, yeah, well, we got divorced last week. Just nobody knew about it. And therefore, there would be, that itself would undermine the stability of the family unit that the Torah is trying to create. So essentially, the Rambam, and the way he explains it in Mar Nevuchim, it's all part of one idea, that marriage is about stability, And for divorce to be too easy or private, that would undermine the stability also. So therefore, the Torah says it has to be in this public way so that the world knows they're either divorced or not. It's not something that just happens quietly in a minute's notice and there's no public record or witnessing or anything like that. So that's consistent with the way he presents it in Sefer Mitzvah. So what's the mitzvah? The mitzvah is not to get divorced, but it's in how it happens. That's the focus. We care about how it happens. So essentially, just to sum up, what do we see here? I see three perspectives. That it sounds like from the chinuch, despite the opening language, the mitzvah is to get divorced. There are times when that has to happen. And of course, it has to be done the right way, but that's the primary mitzvah. According to the Abravanel, it's also that sometimes we need it to happen. But also, how it happens is crucial to the purpose because we don't want it to happen too easily. And according to the Rambam, it's about how it happens. Whether it happens or not, that's up to you. But how it happens, it should happen in a way that is public and somewhat bulky in order that it has a reality to it. Otherwise, it's going to undermine the stability of the family. So all of that ties into how you view this as a mitzvah. So just to quickly recap, and then we'll jump into mincha. So essentially what we saw is that we have this pasuk in Parshas Ki Tzeitzei. So many things are going to need to be defined in terms of what it says. That's going to take the whole year to define a whole mesechta, to define everything in the pasuk and the next pasuk. But the major question we started to talk about today is just the thrust of the whole pasuk. Is the whole pasuk a mitzvah or not? And recognizing that many of the mitzvah counters did count it, what do we do with that? So we saw a lot of categories of mitzvahs. Some mitzvahs are obligations for everyone. It's clearly not in that framework. Some mitzvahs are totally voluntary, like Shvita seems to be. Is it like that? Maybe. Or some mitzvahs are circumstantial, not ideal, but when circumstances happen, that's basically the step. Is it like that? Could be. And we saw that this maybe fits in these three models, that the Rambam's language sounds totally like Shvita, that if you want to do it, here's how to do it. And that fits with his reasoning, that a secret private divorce undermines family stability, so therefore we can't allow that. So if it happens, it has to be this way. While it sounds like from the Sefer HaChinuch that it's more about the divorce itself, the situation, and that sometimes there are circumstances when it has to happen, and we have yet in front of us still to figure out the Mishnah and the end of the Masechta and how that plays into this. And the Abravanel, which is kind of a merger of the two, that it's there for necessary reasons, but also it's important that it be done a certain way. Okay, to be continued, but tomorrow the Parshas.